Hello and welcome back to the Novpod, your beginner's guide to obstetric anaesthetics. This podcast is proudly brought to you in association with the Royal College of Anaesthetists and with the Obstetric Anaesthetists Association. What an episode we have for you. So good, we had to split it into two parts. Duncan and I are joined by Miss Chiara Petroselli. She is a obstetric senior registrar surgeon working in a tertiary hospital in London. She's completing her PhD in maternal mental health, and she provides some of the best definitions and some of the clearest explanations that I've heard of from an obstetrician or even within someone working within the world of obstetrics. I would highly recommend this conversation, and I wish I had it around when I was starting out my journey of obstetrics. So, what we're going to cover over two parts. Well, we're going to go over a mix of human factors, some practical tips, and some core knowledge. We're going to, in this episode, start with some of those human factors. Then we're going to move on to the catetery system and how we manage risk on labour ward. Before we're going to move on to massive obstetric hemorrhage, where we will cover the 40s. Before moving to understand what the surgeons can do to stop massive obstetric hemorrhage. Now, in the second part, we will cover maternal collapse, placental abruption, uterine rupture, cord prolapse, PET. Then we're going to finish on difficult delivery. This is a huge array of topics. You will find all of these in the quick reference handbook that the Association of Anaesthetists has endorsed. However, due to the amount and depth and breadth that we go into some of these topics, we thought it was best to cover it in two parts. Now, without further ado, we're going to get into the conversation. I hope you enjoy as ever. Fantastic. So, welcome back to the episode. I'm Owen. I'm one of your co-hosts. I'm an anaesthetic registrar in Thames Valley, and with me, as always, is
Duncan, anaesthetic
Duncan.
registrar in London.
Always very good at introducing yourself. And today we have Chiara. Hello,
Hello.
Yeah.
Chiara is a senior reg in North Central London who's currently doing her PhD. Chiara, just to kick us off, what do you think makes a good anaesthetist?
You've probably discussed this in the podcast before in lots of different ways, but communication is the single most important thing. I really don't mind working with someone who's very junior or doesn't really understand what's going on. The main thing is just communicating and asking what the situation is, how they can help, someone who's proactive, and someone who takes an interest in what's going on. Unfortunately, in my time, I've worked with some anaesthetists who just kind of sit in the coffee room and have their coffee and will only venture out if they're called to do an epidural, but have no idea what's going on in the big picture. And what makes a real difference is someone who shows up on time, will listen to the handover, will go on the ward round so that they've got a vague idea of what's going on. The end result of that is that when there's an emergency, you don't need to start from scratch. They've got an idea of who this person is and they can intervene much more effectively.
That's pretty comprehensive. I think we've mentioned it earlier in the series as well, like communication is key and also being proactive rather than reactive,
Yes.
like you said.
That actually was gone to my list of top obstetricians, are people who are natural communicators and will go back to a coordinating midwife and almost re-huddle after a Cat 1, Cat 2, and see what else they can do. I always find that really useful.
And, you know, I think as an obstetrician, I would never expect an anaesthetist, no matter how senior or junior you are, to know the ins and outs of exactly why something's happening to a patient or know nuances of obstetric care. I really, really don't mind someone saying, "Really sorry, what does that mean? I've got no idea what that means. Can you tell me?" I'd be more than happy to kind of talk through something. What I do mind is someone who doesn't take an interest, pretends they kind of know what's going on, but then they don't. I'd rather have an open conversation and answer any questions if something's like not clear.
Pretends but knows what's going on but don't. That sounds like your recent MSF, doesn't it, Duncan?
Pretty much. I mean, if you read between the lines, it's like really takes time to think about what they're doing means I scratch my chin a lot and go, yes.
That's not what I wrote for you. Anyway.
I would never send you an MSF, Owen. Funnily enough, what you said makes a good anaesthetist, I would flip back at you and say that's what makes a good obstetrician. I think the team dynamic, that's the key thing. You can very easily go to labour ward as an anaesthetist and think you're just a procedure monkey. You can live like that, but that's probably why quite a lot of anaesthetists have this Marmite relationship with obs. I think actually, if you engage as part of the team, if there's a team dynamic, things run smoothly, your day is better.
Absolutely.
And you have a much better time.
And we have different skills and we need to use them together to get the best outcome for the patient.
Particularly in a specialty where things can flip from elective to emergency and back sometimes, you need to have a good team dynamic in order to identify and communicate that.
As a expert in obstetrics, which is what you build yourself as, you said you were the top obstetrician in the country in the email reply.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's me.
That's you. Given that we've got your expertise in obstetrics, I think this would be really useful for our listeners to hear for your thoughts on a few things. If you were to have had this conversation before you started your novice period with Kiara Duncan, what would you have wanted to get from it?
A big stressor for me before I started obstetrics was talking to my senior anaesthetist colleagues about the role of the dice that an emergency buzzer is on labour ward. So I think it would be interesting to hear your thoughts on, firstly, actually, how as an obstetrician you approach emergency buzzer pulls, and then secondly, how an anaesthetist can approach them from their side in order to work well in a team dynamic in any emergency. And there's a few emergencies we'll go through, which we'll talk through later. What was your approach to an emergency buzzer being pulled, and how, as an anaesthetist, can we help?
Sounds great. From my perspective, hopefully we can go through just like skeleton of knowledge that means that people are less freaked out by a pregnant woman. I often have similar conversations actually with GP trainees who go through obs and gynae or brand new SHOs, and it's just having the confidence to just not be terrified of someone just because they're pregnant. While some things are different, the basics are the same as you would manage so many other things in medicine, so actually you can keep it really simple.
That's good philosophy to have in life and anaesthetics and obs. Now I've asked that question to myself, I kind of want to get an answer from you. So let's say it's midday, we're all about to have a coffee as a team. Emergency buzzer goes off in room 3 on labour ward.
Not room 3.
From your perspective as an obstetrician, how do you approach that?
So often the poor midwife has been there on her own doing lots of different things for the woman, and it will slightly feel like chaos. So sometimes to just ground the room, I will go in and unless it's obvious immediately, I will just say, what is the emergency? And I think you shouldn't be afraid to ask that regardless of what team you belong to, because labour ward can seem like chaos. If you know the headline, then you can create a structure in your head. So if I go in and they say cord prolapse, I've got a protocol in my head and I'm not really going to do an ABC. I'm just going to do my protocol and then do an ABC whilst we're doing the things that I know that need to be done. Whereas if we go in and they say, I'm worried about the CTG, that's where my eyes will go to. But I need to know the headline immediately. Mm-hmm. Really common in obstetrics, regardless of how senior the midwife is, if it's a stressful situation and you go in asking what's going on, you get the B of SBAR before you get anything else. You get a, so this is a 40-year-old woman and she's been doing this and that, and it kind of goes on for 2 minutes and you're like, why did you pull the buzzer? That's why I go in and I just kind of don't really want to know that until I ask for that.
Still going off, right? It provides the perfect soundtrack to any emergency. Yeah.
Literally. That brings me on to my next one. I go in and I say, what's the emergency? Because I want the headline first. And once we've got a couple of people in the room, my next thing is stop the buzzer. First of all, because it's distracting. Second of all, because it freaks the woman out and contributes to trauma. It puts everyone on the same playing field. And so we all know what's going on if you know the headline.
Yeah, absolutely. Pop your head in, eyeball from the end of a bed very quickly, do a mini A to E. Once your obstetric colleague has gotten that headline, quickly go, do you need me right now? And they'll say, no, no. Quickly just do a few double check and then step down, step out of the room and wait. Because I think that is an important thing. And it has burnt me in the past where I've gone, okay, I've been stood down, I'll go back out. And it's only when I go back to have a look at the board that the obs on the monitor suddenly is like, actually, hang on, there's something wrong, I need to go back. So it's good to double check that A, B, and C are actually okay. There's good access that's working. And if not, you know, you can just quickly talk to the woman, reassure them, and pop another cannula in.
If ever there's been a time that you actually need to make sure there's a cannula actually working, it's usually on the obs wards.
Yeah. Rule of cannulas on labour ward is, do not trust it unless you have literally just put it in and given it a big old flush.
See, Chiara, you thought you were coming for us asking you about the various world of obstetrics, and actually we've just come to discuss cannulas with
you.
Yeah.
I love a cannula.
From our perspective, it's incredibly reassuring to have the anaesthetist in the room because you have this sense of, I can focus on what's going on vaginally, and I know that there is another doctor that is taking care of resuscitation and everything else. I can just focus on my task. Yeah. Whereas sometimes when you guys aren't in the room, we can't really do that, and you kind of try and do both, which can be quite stressful. So it will always stick with me. I was an SHO and there was an emergency on layboard. My consultant, who has a really big role in medical education, he's absolutely excellent in the way he communicates and teaches, excellent at situational awareness, and he stood in the corner of the room, didn't get involved, and was allocating jobs. As the anaesthetist came in, he said, anaesthetist, airway, reassurance, and allocated reassurance as a task. And that's what made me think about the fact that actually in the vast majority of cases where there's an emergency, whether it's in the room or in theatre, the anaesthetist is the one at the head end. And you may not realize that it's quite part of your job description, but you are the one delivering the reassurance and doing most of the communicating. And it's important not to forget that even in situations where you think you're quite helpless or you can't really do very much to contribute to the situation, you are actually delivering most of the communication. And it can make an enormous difference to the way that that woman then perceives the trauma and remembers it. Don't forget in an emergency that in addition to doing your ABC, you're doing most of the talking and that woman will remember it.
That's actually a fantastic point, because that's all part of your A2E. You go, hey, hi, I'm Duncan, I'm the anaesthetist. How are you doing? Okay, don't worry, there's a lot of people in the room. Just focus on me for a second.
And that's an enormous job that you guys have, and it's so important. It doesn't need to be very much. It might just be like, I know it looks crazy, there's so many people here, but don't worry, they've each got their own job, everything's fine. So at the moment you're bleeding a bit more than average, we're just giving you some extra drugs. Just needs to be a couple of sentences of chat, but it makes an enormous difference. So I would encourage people listening to this to treat reassurance as one of your tasks in an emergency, unless you're doing something else, obviously.
I really like actually what you've said. And before we get into the meat of the episode onto the various different emergencies that we deal with, how can we as anaesthetists improve our situational awareness as part of the team?
You as an anaesthetist will have priorities of what you want to know to make the woman safe. So once you go in, you want to, you know, make sure that your ABC is generally fine. I'd say once you're happy with that, try and take a step back and look at the room, watch what's happening. So if there's chaos, try and unpick it. If you think there's too many people in the room, maybe question it. If you see the obstetrician struggling with something, don't be afraid to suggest something. I've got lots of examples where, you know, as obstetricians, we were in difficulty, and then it was the anaesthetist that kind of saved us, really, that was like, would you like GTN, for example? And then suddenly you're like, oh my God, yes, thank you. Yeah, of course I do. Thanks. So it's just, once you're happy with your bits, taking a step back and suggesting where the holes might be.
It's like you said earlier, it was kind of like any emergency. It's just the person's pregnant and there's kind of two patients. In an arrest or a peri-arrest, we do exactly the same, right? We go to the airway, we sort the airway out, and then someone else is leading and we're often there to help prompt and guide, rather than judge and tut.
And again, it goes back to communication. It's all about how you suggest and what you say.
Yeah.
Very, very much welcome a suggestion, because you have the best situational awareness most of the time, more than us.
It is quite difficult being a novice anaesthetist, CT2, where you've got a professor or a senior consultant doing something.
Yeah.
What do you think we can do to politely suggest?
One easy way to do that is say in an op, let me know if you'd like any uterotonics. Because that doesn't imply that you know what's going on. It just says that you're happy to help if there is the need. The other thing you can do is, are you okay there? Let me know if you'd like me to call anyone else. And it's better to say that than to say, you need someone else, I'm going to call them. It's about how you ask. One tip that I have in terms of asking about tone, when you're doing a cesarean section, obviously you are slicing the uterus open, you deliver the baby. And you go through that initial kind of couple of minutes where you're closing the uterus and it's a little bit of a mini blood bath and you try and close as quickly as possible. There is absolutely no way that I will know what the tone is like until the uterus is closed. So if you ask me, how's the tone, as soon as the baby's out, it's actually just annoying.
Good to know. Because there's definitely an anaesthetist who just ask it immediately.
If you catch me on a bad day, I'll be like, got no idea yet. Most of the situations after the baby's out, that's the second scariest bit for us, where you've got this blood bath and you're trying to close as quickly as possible. That's all you're focusing on. Having someone ask you to assess something that you can't assess in that moment can be quite stressful. So you can either wait a minute or you can say, let me know if you'd like any uterotonics.
Having closed loop and statements in that time, you definitely get a better response. And it's much easier for you guys to say, yes, no, give me a minute. So one of my big things is, this drug has gone in, carbetocin's in, would you like some tranexamic acid? Yes. Okay, tranexamic's in. Let me know if you want anything else.
Yeah,
Leave it for a bit. If there's silence for a minute or two, check in again. Given this, given that, would you like anything else? Rather than saying, how's the tone? How's this thing?
You know. Completely agree. Yeah. That's much better.
Yeah. I like to say, I see you're failing as a surgeon. For is there anything that I can do to be able to undo your inadequacy? Do you think that's a polite way to
Yeah, why not? Ask politely, say that you're there, close the loop communication, don't make surgical suggestions.
Yeah. Stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane.
We do come from two different advocacy groups.
What I'd say simply is that there may be situations that are slight grey areas where different teams would want to go about things slightly differently. Again, it comes back to communication, but instead of questioning the decision making, just ask, what's your rationale? Because I am worried about XYZ. So instead of just being confrontational and saying, I don't think we should do that, it's just a bad idea, just be really specific. I am worried that this woman has a BMI of X. If I intubate her, she will aspirate.
That's a really good way to firstly improve the question that I was asking you, and secondly, to advocate for the patient, right? You can always then call your anaesthetic consultant to say, this is what we're doing, SBAR with them on the phone.
The importance of highlighting and flagging your concerns from the anaesthetic perspective, but making it a discussion, not
yeah.
I am not doing this because of X. It's a, this is going to be difficult because of X.
Irrespective of what position we're coming from, in obstetrics, the mother always comes first. Mm. Again, bringing it back to keep it simple. Yes, the baby needs to be considered, but mother's always first.
So that's fantastic. Duncan, were you going to ask about cats? You had some question about cats and the number of cats or a category of cats.
Well, how are Ninny and Luca?
I have two cats. This is true. They're great, thank you. Thanks for asking. Thanks.
What cats are they? Describe them. Are they large cats like tigers or are they small cats?
They are small. They are not pure breed. They're very simple people.
Now, speaking of cats, cat one, cat two, cat three, cat four. One of the first things you hear on labour wards, people bandying around cats and numbers of cats. Why do we have this category system, one through four? What does it mean in theory and what does it mean in practice?
In obstetrics, it is really a continuum of risk. You don't really have neat little boxes to put emergencies in, but you have a category system, A, so that you can communicate the severity of risk amongst each other quite clearly. And also the category system, my understanding, it was developed as an audit tool more than anything else, so that you have a standard by which you want certain deliveries to take place by. We go by these time limits depending on the categories, but really with any cesarean, the ethos should be as soon as possible. So as an example, a category one is a situation where there's immediate threat to the life of the mum or the baby, and you want the baby out by 30 minutes. That's your kind of time limit. It doesn't mean that you're going to sit and have a coffee for 29 minutes. It still means that you will try and do it as quickly as possible. Sorry, Owen.
Damn. Hidden in the anaesthetic room.
I normally ask them to hold my coffee whilst I'm doing the spinal.
We mentioned category one. So in contrast to category two is where there is a degree of compromise, either of the mother or the baby, but it's not immediate. And therefore the audit tool says 75 minutes. Again, it doesn't mean sit and have a coffee for 60 minutes. It still means off we go. We're going to do this cesarean. But we're all on the same page and we think that it's reasonable to get this baby out in an hour.
Okay, not to be too superstitious. What if then three cats then come along?
Category three.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Duncan's got his head in the sand at this point.
So I think it's useful to work backwards a little bit. So category four is an elective cesarean section to be done when it suits the team and when it makes clinical sense to do planned surgery, basically. Whereas a category three, you can think of it as an elective that needs to be brought forward. So something that can be planned, but it has a bit of time pressure. It is a continuum of risk, and it's all about, again, it's all about communication.
That's one of the key takeaways, isn't it? It's clarification of what the actual scenario is rather than just the label it's under. Cat 1, there are many different flavours of Cat 1. There are cord prolapse, goddamn, we need to be wheeling things down the corridor right now and getting ready to GA, versus there is a prolonged fetal bradycardia, which is recovering or starting to recover, but we still need to be in theatre because there's been previous signs of compromise.
That's spot on, really. then it's really important to be aware of the fact that the risk can change in one direction or the other. So I've had many times where we rush to theatre for a category one and then actually objectively things are much more stable and we can all slow down and decide whether we even need to do a cesarean at all.
Exactly. And some of the things I like to do to prepare for that when they say cat one is pull to the lady there myself, because I found that's what reduces the cat one time the most.
I think part of your introduction to labour ward should be how to work a labour ward bed and get it moving,
100%. Get the brakes
on. Because you can go to theatre and be like, right, ready to go, psyching yourself up to do a spinal, and time will just go by and the person still won't be there because there is one person left in the room trying to get all these things done.
At Mediplus, we've been working alongside anaesthetists for over 20 years, developing innovative devices you use every day, when high flow is key. Our collaboration has delivered the successful peripheral IV Coventry connector. It's a trusted favourite in delivery suites worldwide. Don't take our word for it. Talk to your colleagues and discover the Mediplus difference. Visit us at www.mediplusuk.com to learn more.
Our novices may, and hopefully will, have dealt with hemorrhage before, right? Say they've dealt with things bleed, surgeons come on, they turn taps off. That's what surgeons are. They're essentially plumbers.
Don't mind that definition. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Particularly
yeah.
Cardiac surgeons.
However, maternal obstetric hemorrhage is somewhat of a different beast in some ways. It buzzes off. Duncan, what was your buzzer sound?
Oh, that's really stressful. I don't like...
All right, so buzzes off. It's maternal obstetric hemorrhage. What are you thinking, Kiara?
As a novice anaesthetist, I know we've just mentioned that things are slightly different in obstetrics, but I'd bring it back to keep it simple and actually don't be freaked out just because she's pregnant or just had a baby. Again, it's as simple as ABC. The basics very much still apply. If you're at a loss of what to do, access and doing some OBS is a good place to start, and you will never be criticised for doing that. Try and figure out by asking the rest of the team where the bleeding might be coming from. There is a system that we use to kind of think through possible causes of hemorrhage. So you may have heard of the four Ts.
True test, right. I got first one. Tone.
Trauma.
Tissue.
Thrombin. Why should we split those into those categories, although those are nice things to think of?
Because it will affect your management and what you do. Thinking through each of those individually. So tone refers to uterine tone. If you think of the uterus, it's a big muscle, it's this enormous distended thing. The second that the baby's out, it's going to need to contract back down. And if it doesn't, those blood vessels are all dilated and they will continue to pour out blood. And the vast, vast, vast majority of primary PPHs will be tone. And which is why, you know, having your uterotonics on standby is so essential, because the vast majority of times, even when tone is not the primary concern, we will be giving uterotonics. In terms of what can contribute to a risk of PPH from the tone perspective, anything that will over-distend the uterus will increase your chance of PPH. So thinking of things like a twin pregnancy, for example, or polyhydramnios, excess amniotic fluid, or if you've got lots of fibroids, because then once the baby's out and the uterus is trying to clamp down, those fibroids will get in the way of the uterus clamping down. So anything that will stretch the uterus out, basically. The other thing that might be helpful to know from your guys' perspective, prolonged labour, so if a woman's in labour loads, it's like any tired muscle. It's been trying to contract for hours and hours and hours and hours. The second that the baby's out, it'll be like this big floppy balloon that can't clamp down. So if you've seen someone that's on the board and they've been on the board for 3 days, you should be thinking PPH risk.
I think that's a really important one.
The other thing to mention in terms of tone is uterine relaxants. So some of the stuff that you guys might give might contribute to an atonic uterus, so a GA, or giving GTN, which we might need for some emergencies. We mentioned category one earlier. So in a category one, sometimes we will want to give a drug called tibutaline, which relaxes the uterus to basically do what we call in utero resuscitation, so to give the baby a break. So we need to give that drug, but it will increase your risk of uterine atony and therefore PPH. So maybe we should talk about some uterotonics then.
Favourite one?
Carbaprost.
Okay. Yeah.
Carbetocin's mine. Why carbaprost?
Once that doesn't work, then...
Favourite backup line one.
Yeah. Every trust will have slightly different pathways, but essentially all women will get some form of oxytocin after they deliver, unless they decide to have a physiological third stage. So yeah, oxytocin. And if that doesn't work, then your first line will be slightly different. I guess the things to bear in mind is ergometrin, which is very good. It tends to give women a lot of nausea. and it pushes up your blood pressure, so we would never give it. We are unlikely to give it in someone with preeclampsia, for example. And carbapross, which is my personal favourite, works very well, but it can cause bronchospasm, so you wouldn't want to give it to someone with asthma.
That was a great summary.
Oh. On to the next tea.
So tissue, we are thinking of products of conception. So it will either be a placenta that is stuck inside for too long or little bits of membranes that are in the way. If you come across a placenta previa or an accreta, where essentially the placenta's plastered to the muscle of the uterus and doesn't come away, that will increase your risk of bleeding. And the treatment for that is essentially surgical. We will need to do something to take those bits of tissue out. But in the meantime, if you think about it logically, if you've got bits of tissue in the uterus, some of the time, as well as causing hemorrhage directly, they will cause hemorrhage indirectly because they are stopping the uterus from clamping down. Therefore, your uterotonics will still be helpful.
Yeah. Very good. Tone, tissue, what's next?
What's next, Owen?
Trauma.
I always tell any new SHO or anyone starting in obstetrics, a good number to remember is the cardiac output to the uterus at term. So you have, at the very, very least, you've got 500 mils of blood per minute going to the uterus at term. That means if you tear through that uterus and don't do something about it, it doesn't take very long before this person arrests. Essentially, surgical bleeding in obstetrics can be really scary for us, and things need to happen very quickly. So trauma can happen in lots of ways. You can have kind of perineal trauma, so the vaginal suturing that we need to do, or you can have trauma within the uterus, and the time that it always happens will be even in a planned cesarean section, you're making an incision of about kind of 5-10 centimeters within the womb. You need to close that quickly. So that's the most common source of trauma. But then depending on how difficult the section is, sometimes you'll have what we call extensions. And that is basically when the angle of the incision will essentially tear down towards the uterine arteries. And that means that the repair will be much more challenging and that it risks being a bit of a bloodbath. So again, in those situations, uterotonics will be helpful because A&E would only worsen the situation. But the treatment is surgical.
Important to highlight what you said about perineal trauma, because I think that's something which can be quite insidious.
Yeah, beware of the slow trickle in obstetrics.
There you go.
And one thing in terms of situational awareness to be aware of is that someone should be weighing swabs regularly. Yeah. Actually quantifying blood loss is so important. And obviously as anaesthetist, that won't be your job, but just make sure that there is someone allocated to that job. Yeah.
Lovely. And then we've got our last two, haven't we?
Thrombin.
Yeah.
Thrombin. I guess with thrombin, we're thinking about things that interfere with coagulation. Obviously, as applies to any form of major hemorrhage, once you lose enough blood, you'll enter DIC. So there's that, of course. So there gets a point in blood loss where all of these factors contribute. Thinking of kind of more simple things, you might have something, pre-existing conditions that contribute to bleeding, like, say, von Willebrand disease, which would be common. Or you might have something that's new. So, for example, preeclampsia. If you have low platelets as part of that, then you're at higher risk of bleeding. The other thing that's worth mentioning is if someone is on prophylactic or therapeutic low molecular weight heparin, that would also count as, you know, thrombin.
One of the key things I find when I'm looking at a board, anyone with any sort of potential, you know, hemophilia trait, if you can, find out what exactly that means. Are they phenotypically likely to bleed? And phone hematology. Get on top of it early, because the last thing you want to be doing is phoning heme while there's a major bleed going on in theatre, because you're already behind. As soon as any bleeding starts, you are behind. So I think that's a real problem you can see coming down the road, and you can take steps to avoid it.
More units are getting point of care, coagulation, screening. And I would really recommend watching either a good YouTube tutorial or just reading up about them so you understand what they actually mean. Because otherwise at 3 a.m. you'll be looking at a champagne glass going,
I'm going to say something controversial as well. TEG and Rotem are great. It's great to know what the bleeding was like and what the clotting was like 30 minutes ago. You don't want to wait for a TEG and Rotem. You need to be treating clinically.
Yeah, and the other thing I'd add to that, so even simpler, so your HemoQ, I'm sure you'll use that more frequently. Yeah. It's helpful, but what has been talked about in the Embrace report a few times is that actually the HemoQ was misleading, and people relied on a single HemoQ, and then that led to serious adverse outcomes. So what ends up being more helpful is the trajectory of the HemoQs over time, for example, if you're using that as a ballpark as to what's happening. But don't make any big decisions based on a single point of care test. Yeah. You should be treating the patient clinically.
Completely agree. TXA, love it.
I absolutely love it. So this is a good time to talk about TXA, I guess.
The magic bullet.
Yeah, so we know that TXA reduces maternal death in hemorrhage without increasing the risk of VTE is the gist. We like to give it a lot. Hmm. And actually thinking back to those TEFA trauma, amazing when you hear sensible anaesthetists be like, would you like some TXA? And then you're like, oh my God, yes, thank you.
Don't forget that you can redose TXA.
It's in the women trial. In that trial, they regave the, if still actively bleeding, the same TXA dose 30 minutes later. So yeah, that's what we use as evidence. I wait 30 minutes.
The relative side effect profile is pretty good from all the evidence we have. It's just don't smash it in super quick, else you will get some tachycardia.
What are the surgical things that people need to be aware of that you can do to stop bleeding? I know we've talked about closing the uterus, right? But are there any other things that people may not have heard of before, like Bakri balloons, etc.?
The simplest surgical intervention for PPH to treat atony is something called a Bakri balloon. Imagine it like Foley's, but the balloon is actually much bigger. And you put it in the uterus, you fill it up with saline, and it essentially provides compression to the myometrium from the inside. So it's almost like doing a bimanual compression artificially, and it stays in for kind of 6 to 12 hours, depending. So that's your kind of first line, and most of the time that will manage atonic bleeding quite well. Worth noting for the anaesthetist is when you put a Bakri balloon in, for it to stay in, you put in a vaginal pack as well. So that's an enormous gauze that goes in the vagina. That woman's going to have a lot of pain afterwards. Different anaesthetists have different approaches to this, but worth bearing in mind that even if they've had a vaginal birth, if they've got a Bakri in a pack, afterwards their analgesic requirements will be very different to a woman who's had a normal vaginal delivery.
Great point. They also get labels on, don't they, so people don't forget. So, Bakri balloon's in.
Yep.
Bleeding's still ongoing.
Okay. So, again, a little bit like in a cardiac arrest, you're going through your 4Hs and 4Ts. In obstetrics, you'd be going through your 4Ts. And if that's the situation, your chances are it's definitely more than one T. If you make the decision to escalate things surgically, then you want to take someone to theatre and you'd want to open them up, a bit like when you do a cesarean section. And we think about doing things like a B-Lynch suture, which is essentially one big massive stitch around the uterus to clamp it down. Again, it's all different ways of trying to clamp down that blood supply to the uterus. And then you can end up doing more extensive things like ligating the uterine arteries, basically lots of different techniques that just reduce the output to the uterus.
Have you ever sent someone to IR to do that? Because that's another team that you can get.
In my experience, often, thankfully, when IR is involved, you predict that there'll be a big blood loss. So they're in theatre from the word go, and they've already done all their lines so that if they need to embolise the uterine artery, they can do it pretty quickly. So they would embolise various vessels to the uterus, whereas we would ligate them from the outside. Whatever's quickest, really.
I think the key thing here is, does your hospital have IR?
Yeah.
Are they in the building?
Yeah.
Are they amenable to coming in the building?
And that's why in MOH, you need a second anaesthetist. And it's not Absolutely. Because you're not an anaesthetist who can manage the fact that you are going to need a second access, you're going to need an arterial line, you're going to need someone to run a tag. And doing that whilst maintaining situational awareness and being able to talk to the obstetrician, you either need to be calling in your boss. And it's always good to check with your boss when they would want to be called in, because some units want to come in at 1.5 anyway.
The way to think about it as a novice obstetric anaesthetist is, would you try and be at an arrest running it from an anaesthetic perspective on your own? No, you want a second pair of hands to be with you so you can manage things and then do the rest. You need to have an overview.
Yeah, because sometimes they may have a spinal, but the amount of operating that you're going to have to do to contain this hemorrhage means that you have to go off to sleep as well. The last line, since you've done the Bakri balloon, B-Lynch suture, you've
ligated
the arteries. Thank you, Duncan. Last line's a hysterectomy.
And at that point, more surgeons in the room, it all gets busier and busier. But in a cesarean section consent form, we will always put life-saving hysterectomy in there.
Hopefully there's something that you never deal with.
We should also probably define what's normal, because I find that people who haven't done obstetrics before sometimes are shocked at the amount of bleeding that we kind of consider normal. So a fair bit of bleeding we can kind of normalise, not to say that PPH isn't concerning, but PPH is 500 mils of blood loss within 24 hours. That's primary PPH. When we refer to MOH, it's when there's blood loss over a litre. And having said that, if someone's having a cesarean section bleeding up to a litre, we would consider normal.
Important to look at the size of the person you're looking at and think about 80 mils per kilo for that person. So someone who is 45 and losing a litre, I would be more concerned at than someone who's 90 kilos.
Not all arbitrary numbers mean the same thing.
And I guess the other distinction to make is primary versus secondary PPH, because primary PPH is blood loss within the first 24 hours of having a baby. Secondary PPH is anything after that, and there's no set criteria on the amount. It's just excessive bleeding after 24 hours. The reason why that distinction is important is because whilst the vast, vast, vast majority of PPHs that are primary will be related to tone, if you have bleeding after that, it's more likely to be something like infection. So, and particularly if it's heavy, it'll be sepsis. The things to think about may be different depending on when the bleeding starts.
Duncan, what was your last point?
Escalate early. Get an extra pair of hands, anaesthetically. Mm-hmm. MDT decisions if second or third line managements of bleeding. And reassure the woman, talk to the woman, explain things. And particularly if you're about to put out a major hemorrhage call, we're going to put out bleep, it's going to get very loud. There's a lot of people coming in. It's just to be on the safe side.
Absolutely.
And I think one thing I say, maybe it's not the best thing, but I say, look, there is some bleeding. We are trying to get it under control. But what's reassuring is you're talking to me and I'm talking to you. Yep. So if things change, if you feel different, you tell me straight away, but you're doing great. There we go. That was my last thing about major hemorrhage.
Hello and welcome to the outro. A big thank you to Chiara for taking Duncan and I so well through the topics that came up in part one of this episode. We have a lot coming up in the second episode. So covered today, we've gone through human factors, practical tips, and we've then gone on to the four T's of major obstetric hemorrhage, along with some surgical techniques that they do. Coming up in the second part will be maternal cardiac arrest and collapse, placental abruption, uterine rupture, and cord prolapse. Some of the peer review group have sent in questions, including asking me to say what a HemaQ is. HemaQ is a company and it provides point of care hematology testing. We'll have some links for you to look at, including a fantastic section in the e-learning for health, which is the serious problems in obstetric anaesthesia. Of course, the quick reference handbook, and then the woman trial, which is quoted a lot about being the evidence for the use of TXA in massive obstetric hemorrhage. As ever, please do share the episode with a colleague or a friend if you think it would be useful, and we have some feedback links that are on the website. So please do let us know your thoughts, and we look forward to seeing you for part two. NovPod out.